Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Dallas County MHMR versus Bosley.
May it please the court, Mr. David LeBrecht and Michael Beattie will present our argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. LeBrecht will open the first 10 minutes, and Mr. LeBrecht will also be rebuttal.
May it please the court, I will address the tort claims issue about use of personal property. Mr. Edie, counsel for the positions in this case, will address the qualified immunity issue.
If you were to prevail on your issue, do we reach the second issue?
I don't believe you do, Your Honor, because of the 106 the judgment in favor of the MHMR precluding the cause of action. Contrary to the way that this case was postured and presented to the Court of Appeals, and contrary to some very, capable arguments of counsel, this case does not involve use of tangible property. What this case involves is the failure of the defendants, or the alleged failure, to adequately supervise Mr. Bosley. That's what gave rise to his escape. That's what gave rise to his opportunity to flee. It wasn't a lock, and it wasn't a door that caused anything in this case.
Why would the Overton Memorial Hospital case not be analogous?
The Overton Memorial Hospital case, Your Honor, is a 1975 case. And I think it is not analogous simply because the facts in this case do not involve the use of a lock. Do not involve any defect, anything defective in the locker in the door itself. That was not the case in Overton, hopefully. I have 3 points that I'll try to make in the 10 minutes that I've got. Number one, information that this court has ruled previously, or lack thereof, or faulty decisions are not tangible property. That's what's involved here. There were some faulty decisions that gave rise to this alleged cause of action. Not using a locking device is not sufficient to waive governmental liability in this court, and other rulings have been very clear. And thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, that this door did not cause Mr. Bosley's death. Contrary to what the Court of Appeals said, involvement is not sufficient. The statute clearly says, so caused by, and simply because a door or a lock is arguably involved does not give rise to a cause of action, thereby a waive governmental immunity by implication. As to the first point, information or lack of it and faulty decisions are not tangible property, I think the court needs to look at the third and fourth amended petitions as well as the recitations in the Court of Appeals opinion about the assertions that defendants, quote, negligently failed to restrain Mr. Bosley from escaping because of what? Those allegations assert that Mr. Bosley was left unattended near the front door, that Ms. Jones unlocked and opened the door without checking Bosley's location, that Ms. Jones didn't ensure that someone was monitoring Bosley, that Bosley ran through the door to I-30, that no staff was present to pursue and restrain him. Clearly, these allegations on the face do not assert anything involving tangible property. Then the plaintiff said that the door or lock caused him to escape. The simple fact of the matter is, by all accounts, what caused him to escape were arguably these other failures to supervise, as well as, and I think this gets glossed over by the Court of Appeals and in plaintiff's argument, Mr. Bosley did not just walk out the door. Mr. Bosley overpowered Ms. Jones and broke through the door. There was a suicide risk. By all accounts, there was a suicide risk, and they had been alerted to the suicide risk. But there is nothing in the record to indicate that Ms. Jones or anyone else had any reason to believe that he would assault her. Nothing whatsoever in the record. It was not the lock, it was not the opening of the lock that caused him to escape and allowed him to escape. It was a perhaps faulty decision to not have people there, to not check with other people, as they allege in the petition. But that does not give rise to a cause of action. under the Tort Claims Act or a waiver of immunity.
Mr. LeBrecq, let me ask a question. Suppose A&M's got some sort of deep sea research vessel, and I suppose it's got some watertight doors on it, and it's out on the ocean or something, and it starts taking on water, and one of the sailors forgets to lock the watertight door, and the water gets to that level and rushes through the door and floods the boat, and now someone's injured someone's injured inside this compartment or something because it's flooded. The boat survives, it doesn't sink, but they're flooded. Wouldn't the argument be that if the door had been used properly, that this person would not have been injured, and wouldn't that be a very strong argument that that was the improper use of tangible property? This door, if it had been shut, it would have protected me from my injury, and it was left simply unlocked or simply open.
Justice Enoch, I think that is the case, and I can't argue with that. But carrying that to its ultimate extreme, and I think the decision that this court has to wrestle with once again in this case is how far do we carry that? And using the scenario in this case, as we end in our brief, do you include he used the telephone? If the telephone hadn't been there, he wouldn't have been in the hallway. He walked on the hallway. The key that she used, is that tangible property? And I can't tell the court how far you extend this, but what I can tell the court, and kind of leads into my third point, is the causation issue. There's got to be some causal nexus in using your example. There is a connection, clearly, between the flooding of the compartment and the opening and the failure to lock the door. In this case, is that causal nexus there? I think, as the court has said in other cases, and some of the appellate courts have said, it's a little too attenuated in this case as a matter of law. Unlocking that door was one small piece in a whole string of facts that ultimately may have led or may have been involved in his suicide. But that's not the causative element here as a matter of law.
Can we say if the door had been locked that he would not have gotten out?
Yes, sir. We can also say if there had been security there, he would not have gotten out.
So that's not the issue here. The issue here is the door locked. And you're conceding that if the door had been locked, he would not have gotten out.
He would not have gotten out had he not overpowered Ms. Jones.
But
I
know you can speculate about a bunch of things, but if the door had been locked, he would not have gotten out.
I think I have to concede that point. Had the door remained locked, he would not have gotten out. But again, the distinction I'm drawing is it is not the door that's the causative element. It's all of these other things in the progression. Had he been properly supervised, and that's the plaintiff's argument. It's a lack of supervision. The lock just happened to be one small piece of that.
I don't want to keep beating a dead horse, but explain to me why this is not a but-for causation issue. If you're saying that if the door had been locked, it would not have gotten out, why would that not mean but-for causation?
Because the statute in this case says so caused by. I think had the door been locked, he would not have gotten out, but I don't think you can say, ergo, his suicide was so caused by that lock being open. It is one small piece in the big puzzle. Again, on my third point, that is the causation, and then I'll turn the podium over to co-counsel. The use of the doors did not cause Mr. Bosley's death. Entirely too attenuated. In order to have foreseeability, there were no prior assaults, nothing in the record of any prior assault. There were no threats of assault. There were no prior attempts to overpower. There's nothing in the record.
But was there information that Mr. Bosley was an elopement risk?
Your Honor, I think there's a vast distinction between believing that he is an elopement risk, i.e. that he might elope if you leave doors open. That's a far cry from the criminal act of assaulting Ms. Jones and she's coming or going to lunch.
Is it really, someone trying to escape going back to the high security building, wouldn't that hurt bother that they would use all kinds of things to leave?
I think that's the reason the door was locked, and that's very clear from the physician's testimony. But people do have to come in and out of doors, and that the door was unlocked. And it's not, again, the locking of the door that gives rise to the causation. It's the fact that there wasn't adequate security. And the problem that we have here, if the court rules in this case that that was sufficient, you have effectively waived governmental immunity. Because in any case, there's going to be a piece of property involved. In addition, I would like counsel to explain how the condition of this lock or the open lock is somehow involved in this case, because quite candidly, I cannot understand that there's nothing defective about the lock. It was either locked or it was unlocked. And in this case, both locks were unlocked ultimately. What is defective about the condition? If you read the definition,
does it have to be defective to be negligent use or non-use?
Well,
I know we get into that.
I don't think non-use gets them there.
I understand that.
If they're talking about a condition, I think it has to be defective, or something about the condition needs to be wrong. Just because a door is locked or unlocked, I see that as use or non-use. That is not a condition. The council argues that. But I would submit that there's nothing about the particular condition of the lock itself that caused anything. Justice Spector, getting back to your question just momentarily, there were no prior attempts to escape, and I don't think Ms. Jones, just because he was on a suicide risk, whether she knew or didn't know, was called upon to assume that he would in fact assault her. That would be pure speculation on her part, and that again gets back to the failure to supervise or inadequate security.
If he had been in his room and all the other facts are clear that he is a suicide risk, and the screen and the window were removed in some way or left open, and he jumped from the building,
I don't think there's any difference, because I would make the same argument if that were the case. It's a failure to supervise. There's nothing about the screen that caused him to fall. It's the failing to provide, or lack of the screen that caused him to fall. It's the failure to supervise. And that's what the plaintiffs allege in this case. I commend counsel, because they've made a very artful argument to try and get around the Tort Claims Act, but you can't do it. And if you do it in this case, you will open the door and totally, by judicial decree, waive governmental immunity again, as the court clearly understands that's up to the legislature to do.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. May
it please the court. My name is Mike Eady. I represent Drs. Kempis and Urshan. The question of official immunity is a question that must be decided in a context atmosphere. And the context here is against several different factual backgrounds. The first one is the type of patient population the psychiatrist employed by the state of Texas must treat. Now, this is a legislatively defined population of people. If you're involuntarily committed to the custody of the state of Texas, there has to be a judge to make that determination. It's a determination that you're mentally ill, and that your mental illness is such that you're a danger to yourself or to others. By virtue of the fact that you're involuntarily committed, meaning that you don't want to be there in the first place. So the population that the state psychiatrists are asking to treat is a population of very high-risk patients who don't want to be treated. Next, you must treat those patients within the context of only certain available governmental resources. This case is a prime example. Dallas County, there's only 9 state hospitals in this state. If you live in the Dallas area, the state hospital in that area is Terrell State Hospital. If you're committed in that area, you can start off at what's called the MDC, which is the Medical Diagnostic Clinic. They have a mental illness court inside the clinic itself. That's a triage point. You go into that center, a judge hears the case, and if he finds upon clear and convincing evidence that you have a mental illness and you should be committed, then he will commit you to the custody of the state of Texas. Then he must decide, also upon hearing evidence, what facility is you're going to go to. There's just two choices. There's the Terrell State Hospital, and there's the Hillside Center. Now, the Hillside Center is operated by the Dallas County MHMR. It's a very small facility. It's a 20-patient facility. It's mainly for a two-week stabilization period. Most of the patients there are voluntary, and it's not staffed like Terrell State Hospital. They're not accustomed to dealing with the same type of people that are in the Terrell State Hospital. That's the resources that are available. Now, the government is even more, or the state here, is even more involved in the actual treatment than just that. In this case, the probate judge put Roger Bosley in the Hillside Center. He made that decision against the recommendation of every psychiatrist who ever saw Roger. He sent him there because that was his determination. And if the psychiatrists have any big complaint, it's that they were faced with a patient here who was put in a facility that they didn't agree with that being the proper facility. It was thought he should go to the Terrell State Hospital in the first place. But once he's there, they don't have any choice but to treat Roger Bosley. And they don't even have a choice on how to transport it. That has to be approved by the mental illness board again. They can release him, but if they want to send him to a more secure environment, because he's within the custody of the state of Texas, they can just make a recommendation. And that's exactly what happened here. That's the proof that's attached to the response to the motion for summary judgment, plaintiff's response. The actual motion itself for a modification of the in-custody protective order.
Any questions?
First of all, do you agree with Chief Justice's initial question from Mr. LeBrecht that if there's a favorable ruling as to the MHMR, that we don't reach the issue about your client?
Yes, Your Honor, that's my sincere hope.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Ogle, for the argument for the respondent. May it please the court, my name is Robert Ogle, and I represent Albert and Elaine Bosley, the respondent in this case. Three issues. Official immunity, governmental immunity, and the relationship between official and governmental immunity. I'd like to respond to that in that order. First, with regard to official immunity, this court laid down rules in the medical context on official immunity in the case of Cassin versus Hatton.
But you do agree that we have to affirm the Court of Appeals on their decision on governmental immunity before we ever get to official immunity.
Only with regard to Angela Jones, possibly, not with regard to the other defendants, because the other defendants in the petition were never alleged to be involved in the cause of action, which gave rise to the action against MHMR. You look at the petition, the actions of Angela Jones are kept separate from the actions of the other employees. So you can still reach the official immunity question with regard to the other. In Cassin versus Hatley, this court held that in order for a medical personnel to receive official immunity, they must conclusively prove that they were exercising governmental discretion in connection with the acts complained of, or that their discretion, their medical discretion, was somehow colored by governmental factors of concern. Now, in this particular case, the defendants attempted to meet that burden by filing affidavits. And they filed their affidavits pre-Kaplan, and they filed them under the old uniquely governmental standard of Mark Darris. Because of that, their affidavits have failed. All the defendants in their affidavits indicated that they were exercising professional judgment and professional discretion. However, they did not indicate that they were exercising governmental discretion. And more importantly, they never linked up any supposed exercise of governmental discretion of factors or concerns with their medical discretion. The doctors indicated in their affidavits that they had to treat each patient that was involuntarily committed
and that they had limited treatment options, and that they could only refer the patients to a governmental facility. Now, this latter fact was contradicted by Dr. Camphouse in his deposition, where he admitted that they could indeed refer to a private institution, and the standard was the same, so there's a fact issue with regard to that. However, in the affidavit, there is a complete failure to relate any governmental discretion with the acts complained of. In this particular case, the acts complained of are a failure to give suicide precautions and elopement precautions, and to enforce those precautions. There is no evidence in this case, in the affidavits, that the suicide and elopement precautions were not given because they had to treat each patient, or that there were limited treatment options, or that there were scarce state resources, such as not enough people, not enough staff, that there was not a room available at the mental diagnostic clinic, or any other governmental factor of concern. So this case is very similar to Kasson versus Hatley and various courts of appeals opinions, including Gross versus Inns, which this court heard about a month ago, where there is a complete disconnect between any supposed governmental factor of concern and the medical discretion. Now, in the brief, the petitioners have made the additional argument that because they were required to treat Roger Bosley under the Mental Health Code, that this somehow colored their medical discretion. However, there is absolutely nothing that is contained in their affidavits indicating that the Mental Health Code in any way changed the standard of care with regard to how to treat Roger Bosley. In fact, the deposition testimony is to the contrary, where Dr. Urschel testified that patients received the same quality of care at Hillside as at any private institution. He wasn't taught anything differently about suicide precautions at Hillside than at other institutions, one of which included a private institution. And Dr. Camphouse testified that people are at Hillside Center both voluntarily and by court order, and there is no difference in the standards of care on how they're treated. Two additional quick arguments why that argument must fail. The Mental Health Code, the purpose is not to alter the standards of care, but to ensure that doctors that are treating patients that have been committed adhere to standards of care. It's a safeguard. And for, the petitioner's argument is apparently that this court should use these safeguards as a basis for official immunity, which would in effect remove all the safeguards. And that is certainly not what the legislature intended to the Mental Health Code.
Mr. Oak, how did the door or the lock cause the death to the deceased?
Well, we have two doors in this case. We have an outer door and we have an inner door.
How did either door or either lock cause the death of the deceased?
The morning of the 12th on Friday, Roger Bosley had been diagnosed as being suicidal, and he was also considered to be an elopement risk because he didn't want to go to Terrell State Hospital. The very piece of property that the doctors and the nurses decided would protect Roger Bosley, keep him out of harm's way, were the doors. They decided that they would keep him inside the facility through the use of the doors, the locked doors. This had a double door locking system. And because they recognized, and in fact that was their policy, to lock the two doors whenever anybody wanted to be transferred back to Terrell, because they didn't, generally people did not want to go back. So this was the very property designed to protect Roger Bosley. When the doors were taken away, it was very similar to this court's case in Lowe versus Texas Tech, where originally a knee brace was given for protection of the football player, and then the knee brace was taken away. Very similar to this case. Originally, the doors were given as protection to Roger Bosley to keep him inside the facility. And at some point during that morning, the inner door, self-locking door, was opened and left in an open condition. And then Angela Jones, without checking the position of Roger Bosley or making sure that somebody was looking after him, negligently unlocked and opened the front door, thereby allowing him to escape the facility. So that is the cause of the action.
I have two questions. Why is that not inadequate security or supervision?
Well,
and once you answer that question, if we were to write an opinion the way that you're asking, inviting this court to do, is that in the sovereign immunity or official immunity?
No.
There will always be some use of property in dealing with patients.
I understand that there's a line drawing issue here for the court. First of all, there may well be negligent supervision issues in this case. And we've also alleged that that they should have been watching Roger Barsley more closely in this case and should have been monitoring. However, we have specifically alleged the use of the doors as triggering the Texas Tort Claims Act. This court has, although the section has caused problems and continues to cause problems, this court has come up with or has established various general rules, one of which there must be a use, there cannot be a non-use, must be tangible property.
Why is this non-use of a lock?
Well, because Angela Jones affirmatively used the door by unlocking it and opening it. There's affirmative use.
But that's the deceased. The non-use of the lock caused the accident or caused the...
Well, because there is an affirmative use of this tangible property. Originally, well, the medical decision was to use the doors as the protective device, and then similar to Lowe versus Texas Tech. And so what Angela Jones did is she affirmatively used the door. Use of a door is not non-use of a door.
All right. If we grant you that, what about the intervening cause? He overpowered the nurse or the lady that opened the door.
Okay. First of all, there's no...
Does that enter into the equation, or should it enter into our analysis?
No, Your Honor. First of all, there is no evidence that there's an assault involved. Apparently, he waited for his opportunity and then he ran by Angela Jones. I think he might have done some physical contact. But understand the context that this occurs in, because Roger Bosley had been diagnosed as being with major depression. And a person that is suffering from major depression is not in control of their mind or their faculties. The medical personnel have testified that they do very irrational things, unpredictable things, like try to run out of the door and escape and commit suicide when they're faced with the prospect of going to Terrell State Hospital, which Roger Bosley was very, very scared of. If I could return just briefly to my official immunity argument, the last section would be 57.019, which specifically preserves liability for negligence, except in limited circumstances that are not applicable here, and that statute recognizes the difference between negligence that is preserved and quasi-judicial activity, which is granted immunity. Those circumstances are not applicable here. So therefore, official immunity is not available to the individual defendants because there is no evidence that they were exercising governmental discretion. Now, we have gotten into the issue of governmental immunity, and let me get into that a little further. The specific allegations in this case are that Angela Jones unlocked and opened the front door to the center when the condition of the inner door was open, which allowed Roger to elope. Now, if I could repeat and strengthen my argument with regard to the use, these facts fall squarely within the established rules on use of property. It has always been the rule from this court that when property is affirmatively used, or property is used and then taken away, or property is used in a defective condition, then the standard is met. In that line of cases is Lowe with the knee brace, and Overton with the bed rails, and Robinson with the life preserver. And it was recently restated in Kerrville State Hospital versus Clark. These facts fall squarely within the present, and as I've stated, they're very similar to Lowe in that the doors were given and then the doors were affirmatively taken away. This case is actually stronger than Overton and Robinson, because in those cases, the property was never first given in the first place, but a portion of the property was not given. This case is not similar to the non-use cases that this court has recently struggled with, Kerrville State Hospital versus Clark and Kaplan versus Hatton, because it, in fact, does involve affirmative non-use. Now, with regard to the causation issue, apparently the petitioners in this case are arguing for direct causation, and that is simply not the law. The clause that we're dealing with, the so-caused by language, has been interpreted by this court as referring back to the causation language in the earlier section, which involves proximate causation, involving the negligent act or omission or the negligence of an employee. This property meets the causation standard because it, in fact, was the very piece of equipment that the doctors were trying to protect Roger Bosley by. So it is approximate cause.
You admit, though, that this was not the instrumentality that caused the death?
In this case, the truck caused the death. And in the low case, it was the football player collision that caused the injury, not the Negroes. In the Robinson case, it was the water that caused the death, not the lack of a life preserver. In Overton, it was the floor that caused the injury and not the bed rail. But that is not a problem under the classic law of proximate causation. It need not be the instrumentality of harm. It need only be a proximate cause or involved in a proximate cause chain.
If that's the case, if there had been change the facts, and the fact that he was using that phone placed in that situation, given all the other facts, placed him in a situation where he could flee once the door is open for any reason. The use of the phone, you make the same argument by the mere fact that the phone is there in that place under those circumstances?
Well, Roger Bosley would be using the phone in that condition. I mean, in that situation.
That waive immunity, would that trigger? Is that enough to trigger the waiver of immunity?
That would be closer to, I believe, a condition of property rather than a use of property, because the defendants would have placed the phone in a certain condition and it would have been there on a permanent basis, and there would be no contemporaneous use of the phone by the defendants. And so it wouldn't fall under the use provisions. It may fall under a condition of analysis. So we clearly have a use here that triggers the waiver of immunity. Now, the Bosleys have also alleged that a condition of property also triggered the waiver of immunity. They have specifically alleged that the inner door was left open and unlocked in an unlocked condition, allowing Roger to escape. Now, the causation argument on the inner door is the same as the causation on the outer door. It has to refer back to the earlier paragraph, proximate causation involving an act or omission of negligence by the employee. And we would contend in this case that the condition is also satisfying because it was the act or omission or negligence of an employee at the center which resulted in the condition of the inner door being left open. And also, it is connected to the use of the outer door by Angela Jones. Part of what makes Angela Jones' use of the outer door negligence is the fact that the inner door was in an open condition. And it was Angela Jones' use of the outer door that brought the condition of the inner door into the causal chain in this case. And so we believe you do have the causation standard met under the earlier paragraph.
Under your argument, would the pen that was used by the probate judge to send this individual to that facility be just the property that triggered the weight of sovereign immunity?
Well, first of all, I believe the probate judge would be entitled to immunity.
They're focusing on the property that's used. And there's a connection. But for the judge signing the order, with that particular tangible piece of property, and there would be, it would be here.
Well, I believe that under proximate causation, I mean, there is some point where it cuts off. That would be too attenuated, I believe. But again, in this particular case, it is because it is the doctors themselves that chose the doors to be the property to protect Roger. Because the doors were not properly used, that allowed Roger to escape. And it falls right into it satisfies the proximate
causation. I don't understand the doctor's liability comes from what decision they made.
Yes, Your Honor. The way that the case has been pled is that if you look at the jurisdictional statement in the Fourth Amendment petition, only Angela Jones and the center got notice under the Tort Claims Act. And in the petition, it is the acts of Angela Jones, the affirmative use of the door, that triggers the Tort Claims Act. All of the other defendants are, the pleadings involve a failure to order and a failure to do things, which we admit do not trigger the rise of the cause of action under the Tort Claims Act. And so we are pursuing the doctors and the other staff members on an individual basis for medical negligence, and we are not seeking to face governmental waiver by MHMR on any act of the doctors or the other staff members. Which leads to the final issue, and that is the relationship between official immunity and governmental immunity. And I would say, first of all, that this court need not reach this issue because sovereign immunity is not appropriate in this case, and so there will not be a judgment against MHMR, which will protect Angela Jones under 101.106. But assuming, for the sake of argument, that there was,
finish your sentence, please.
Under 101.106, it states that the immunity is limited to the employee whose acts gave rise to the cause of action. And we have alleged that only Angela Jones' acts have given rise to the cause of action against the mission.
Any other questions? Thank you. Could you address this last point first?
Sorry, I was taking notes on what I was anticipating. I completely missed it.
That only Ms. Jones, if in the event that this case does not fall under Robinson and Lowe, and it's not a use of property, that only Ms. Jones would be protected under 101.106. The other defendants would still be liable to be sued. Get any official immunity on.
I can't concede that point simply because I think this has not been argued. But I think there's a distinction between the medical decisions that were made and carrying out of those decisions, which the carrying out is what's involved here, what the physicians make the decision. The governmental matters involved are the actual carrying out and providing the security. And I think there's anything medical about actually providing the security, what the physicians have been. I think the employees, certainly Ms. Jones involved as well as the other employees, would be entitled to that protection under the qualified immunity. I want to get back to a question that Justice Abbott asked earlier, and it was probably obvious that I couldn't think of which case Overton was, but it was the Clinton case. I think that ties right in with the Lowe decision, the Robinson decision. All of those cases I distinguish, and this court distinguished them. In the Kerrville versus the Clark case. Those cases specifically involved situations where a bed rail was clearly not provided. That caused an injury. No question about it. The life preserver was not provided. And if the life preserver had been there, I think by all accounts, the drowning would not have occurred. The eyeball case, the Rockville Mockery case, had the string been in there, but the eyeball would not have walked down the drain. Different issue here, Judge. This is a different issue because had the lock been there, who's to say that he still would not have figured out a way to get out the door? It's the causation issue that I focus on in this case. I think it's entirely too attenuated, and that's how I distinguish this case. And the problem that I have, and it, this is not an easy issue, as you certainly can tell by your question. The problem that we have is if you waive immunity in this situation, every case you will effectively waive sovereign immunity. I don't know exactly where you draw the line, but I don't think this is the case.
Yeah, I don't see it quite that extreme because if it were waived in this case, I don't see why it would be waived in the Kerrville case. That was non-use of drugs.
I don't believe you agree with the majority.
Well, I didn't, but I'm stuck with it anyway.
I think that the Kerrville case was a closer issue, not to argue with the majority in the case, but I think there was a closer issue than the in this case because that actually was a decision of which drug to administer. So I think that's more of an abuse case. I get back to my real basic common sense issue. The door was locked or it wasn't. And there's nothing defective about a lock. And there's no allegation that there was anything defective. The Court of Appeals concluded that they said it was defectively something or other. But there's nothing in the record to indicate that there was anything defective. It was simply misused. Part of people that this Court has clearly said that that's not sufficient. That's a causation issue. I need not go back over that. But clearly, if he had gotten on the bus while hitchhiking, and it was a city bus, that's another use of the tangible property. That's a whole lot closer in proximity to the door. Therefore, the use of the bus would give rise to liability as well. And it goes on and on from there. And that's not the legislature intent. This is not a fairness issue. Unfortunately, for the Muslims, there's nothing fair about sovereign immunity. I've never contended, and those of us that practice in this area have never contended that it was. Nothing fair about it at all. It's simply that's what the law says.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments for today. All these arguments these causes will be submitted on brief and oral arguments, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All right. Oyez, 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 the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas, now standing adjourned.